last 10 years, things haven't changed. There's been limited resources, and the limited resources tend to be focused on things that are in the public eye, namely things like cancer treatment or treatment, for instance, in orthopedics of children with spinal problems, scoliosis. So the problem is, if you focus on one thing, it tends, and there isn't enough resources, other things suffer. And basically, if you have cancer and your operation is cancelled, you're more likely to end up on the front page of the paper than if you're sitting at home using crutches, taking painkillers with arthritis. So every focus in the health service is designed to minimise bad PR, bad publicity, and unfortunately, if something has to give, it's invariably planned or elective surgery, sort of things like joint replacements in my case, things like hernias, varicose veins, and things of that nature in the general surgical sphere. So basically, if you have a limited resource and you devote more of it to one area, unless you increase your expenditure and resources, then other areas suffer.
We hear the term emergency department crisis, trolley crisis. Do you think that's really the issue here?
Well, that has been a myth that I have been complaining about for years. There's no point in building new emergency departments, staffing them with more consultants, more nurses. What you need to do is put those resources into the infrastructure in the actual hospital so the patients can leave the emergency department. There's no point in making a bigger emergency department so people are more comfortable staying there. You want to get them out of the emergency department so they can get the proper treatment they want in the general hospital rather than staying in the emergency department either on a trolley or in a bed there.
So currently as it stands then, the trolley figures have become sort of the bywords or sort of the headline now. We highlight them as much as we can, but it is really only the tip of the iceberg in that the knock-on effects that it has on someone like yourself and the work that you can do. I know you've done it before, but just to once again, how does overcrowding in an emergency department mean that you can't you're there, ready, willing, and very keen and able to do it, of course. How does the trolley crisis or the emergency department crisis stop you doing your work?
Well, if the hospital needs to take people out of the emergency department, put them in beds, they put them in any bed that is available. And if a bed can be used for a joint replacement or a bed can be used for a patient on a trolley in the emergency department, the patient on the trolley in the emergency department gets preference, and then the surgical patient whose operation was planned gets cancelled. So effectively, if you had sufficient beds, then we could work. Because of lack of beds, there is no bed for us to put our patients in. Last week I did 3 joint replacements. I could have done 5, but 2 were cancelled because of bed issues. And the 3 patients went home after 2 days. So basically, my patients occupied less than 1 bed for an entire week. 3 joint replacements were done. But that is more the exception than the rule. It used to be for about the month of January. Now it's for 3 months of the year, if not 4 months of the year.
3 people's lives changed.
And there were three very happy people going home on Friday evening, but it's almost like a lottery. You almost congratulate them on winning the lottery when a patient gets into a bed for an elective procedure at the moment.
In a way, are we exacerbating the problem focusing on how many people are on trolleys on a daily basis, or is that useful? In other words, if you talked about let's oil the squeakiest wheel, are we inadvertently adding to the problems?
In some respects, yes, because for about the last 8 years at least, we have been pouring money into emergency departments. And the problem is that increasing the number of staff there didn't solve the problem. It basically ignored the problem because it was where the patients came from rather than where the patients are going to. And if all that money had been put into putting in extra staff on wards and opening up extra wards, then the emergency department wouldn't have been under the pressure they're in. So there's cause and effect. Unfortunately, they were treating the effect rather than the cause, and the cause was the lack of beds.
I said it to you before, I worry when we don't hear your voice, and I think you said to me that you'll keep speaking even after maybe that you've retired, which hopefully is not for some time to go. But my point really, what I'm trying to get at is, how do we affect change here then? Because we can't get people in great numbers out onto the streets. No disrespect to the hundreds that came out into the streets in Letterkenny there not so long ago, but we're talking, you need thousands, you need a movement, you need a Irish water type movement, I think. But what do you see being the catalyst for actual change, whereby it's not a sticky plaster sort of way we have of running things?
Well, I think we need a sea change in attitude. I mean, I think it will take 8 or 10 years to resolve the problem, but the solutions that they're putting forward and the solutions and the people who are putting forward the solutions are the people who created the problems that have existed for the past 10 years. I think we need a sea change in attitude. I mean, our Minister, Simon Harris, who I have great respect for, has put this plan forward for putting 3 new hospitals in the country, in I think Galway, Cork, and somewhere in on the east coast, southern east coast, and this will resolve the problem. That's not going to happen in my career, certainly, and it'd be unlikely to happen in my lifetime. The problems are local and they should be dealt with locally. So there's no point in building a mega hospital somewhere in the middle of the country because people don't want to go to it. You need to put individual resources into individual hospitals. An extra 50 beds in Letterkenny would probably resolve our problems.
In the hospital itself?
In the hospital itself.
And that's staff, because beds, you can get beds anywhere. You can get beds in a magazine. When we talk about beds, we're talking about staff, aren't we, Doctor, really?
Well there's physical beds and building the buildings and getting the staff. But the other big problems, as I see it, Mary Harney started the NTPF, outsourcing to private hospitals. Mm. The number of private hospitals that have been built in the last 15 years is amazing. The problem with that is, for every private hospital you build, you need a medical and nursing and ancillary staff, physiotherapists, cleaners, occupational therapists, radiologists, radiographers, etc. Those people who were trained in the public sector are moving into the private sector. So every time you put another 100 million into the private hospital sector, you're taking staff away from the public sector, which makes it even harder for us to recruit and do work.
Especially in more outlying areas, potentially.
Yeah, it's an ongoing self-perpetuating problem. Mm. I mean, roughly in the past 10 years, I suspect, or 10 or 12 years, roughly a billion has been put into the private hospital sector. Now, if that money had been put into the public hospital sector, we wouldn't have the long waiting list that we have. We wouldn't have people on trolleys. I think it was a very short-sighted plan which is self-perpetuating in its ongoing problems. And you get the private hospital sector offering to help out the public sector by doing lots of work for them, and if they increase their capacity, they'll take more of our staff, which will mean we'll be even higher pressure or greater pressure to recruit staff. So it's a self-perpetuating problem.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from there. Discharging, getting people out of the hospital. Often we hear in this programme about discharge letters, and people are well able to leave, but they're holding on to beds for much longer than they can. Have you an insight into that?
It's not that great a problem. I don't know where the thing about discharge letters came from. Most of the time, patients are discharged in a timely fashion. Sometimes a patient is told they'll be discharged subject to a result being available. So it may mean them having to go down for an investigation of some kind. It may need them to wait for a blood test result or an X-ray result. But by and large, patients are discharged in a timely fashion. We certainly do in my specialty in orthopaedics. I mean, we're in at 8:30 in the morning, and if a patient is good to go, we tell them that. Sometimes they haven't actually left the hospital till mid-afternoon by the time relatives come and collect them. But by and large, if a patient is going to be discharged, it doesn't delay things during the course of the day. There are discharges that are delayed for weeks at a time because a patient lives alone or awaiting a convalescence or some form of step-down bed, but that's a different issue. But, you know, if a patient is ready to go home on a day, it is rarely delayed for paperwork or administration.
Just one moment. Brian wants to come in on this. Good morning to you, Brian. Your point there?
Good morning. Yeah, I'm just puzzled by a strange phenomenon. I had the misfortune to cut my thumb rather badly trimming coasters and on a New Year's Eve night, and I landed after being sent by the now doc to the hospital to have it stitched at 9 o'clock roughly on New Year's Eve. There wasn't one other being there. Now, my relatives who have been to accident emergency referred by the doctor have sat all night waiting to get in, but on New Year's Eve there wasn't one other person there. Does that indicate that for the night that was in it, there were no accidents, which is a bit incomprehensible.
So you're saying the public may be misusing the ED services?
That would seem to be a plausible explanation, wouldn't it?
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Brian. Mr. O'Rourke, I don't know.
Well, things like that are not uncommon, shall we say. My colleague who's on for the weekend for St. Patrick's Week had a very quiet weekend. I'm expecting a bit of a deluge today because the festivities are over, so it's not unusual. If there's a sporting event on, you can quite often find that the emergency department is deserted, but two or three hours after the sporting event is over, quite often there's a mass arrival that people have put things off. So people can put things off and put going to the emergency department off if they have a good reason in their eyes for it. So that's why there is quite often lulls in activity. Mm. But the unfortunate thing is, regardless of whether there's a lull or not, the staff are there and have to be available there. One of the things that people don't realise when it comes to hospitals is that a hospital works 168 hours a week. Most other people work 40 hours a week. So you require four times the staff, and you have to have staff available 24/7, unlike most occupations, which are a 40-hour time frame.
How has this year up until now, in terms of, I mean, you're there available to do 100% of what you're able to do. I don't know what percentage you're running at this year compared to last year.
It's a difficult question. Statistics are always difficult to look at. 2 years ago, we would have done a lot more. Last year, we did very little because we had staffing issues. This year, we've done more than last year, but less than the year before. So it's up and down. So, in regard to things like joint replacements, which is the area that we would have most of our inpatients in, we did 320 in calendar year 2016, 220 last year. The year before, I think we did 318 or something like that. So it goes up and down. Theoretically, we should do more in the summer months and less in the winter months because of bed issues, but it doesn't always work that way. We even had escalation last summer causing cancellation of lists. So it's become a year-round problem rather than just a winter months problem.
And very finally, you know the plans that are in place. You say you've had much respect for the Health Minister, and quite rightly so, perhaps, but in terms of his ideas going forward, you know, because this is not a 1 month, 3 month thing. This is perhaps a 4, 5, 10 year plan, perhaps, that we need or maybe introduce. The suggestions that are out there, do you think they are going to address the problems or fix them even?
No.
Well, who would the minister be liaising with? I mean, you're a person and others. You speak publicly. It's more difficult for others to do so. But you are the people that I would be consulting with, to be honest with you, if I were to be making decisions on the health service. Does that happen? Is there enough consultation with people that are actually...
I don't really know. I mean, if you take it for the in terms of the fact that for the last 12 years we've had the same problem, which got worse year on year, it begs the question, is whoever is giving the advice to the minister the right person? And I would certainly have to question that. The Sláinte group of political party report that they produced had some good ideas and some absolutely mad ideas. But the problem is that you get politicians involved, you get civil servants involved, you get doctors involved, but it isn't always the right ones and the ones who see what is actually required at the coalface.
Okay.
What works for Dublin doesn't necessarily work for Letterkenny or Sligo or Kerry or Cork. And the problem is they have a one size fits all. I mean, the typical example of that was recent bad weather, where things in Letterkenny were cancelled and we had hardly a drop of snow on the ground and we could have actually worked, yet someone in Dublin made a decision for the entire country which actually impacted on our ability to treat patients because they didn't realise that we weren't suffering the weather conditions they were.
Couldn't agree with you more on that one. And I think we need those decisions to be taken regionally. I don't know if the local authorities need to take a responsibility, because there were issues actually within Donegal itself that were different, but for one group or person making all those decisions in Dublin doesn't make sense. Mr. Peter O'Rourke, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Cheers.